In today's lecture on church history, we're going to take another look at the Byzantine Empire and Eastern Christianity. We're going to touch on some things that we've already covered, but just for the sake of repetition and to helping us get it down, we'll talk about the Eastern Church, what is sometimes called the Byzantine Empire. The Byzantine Empire existed for 1,123 years, from AD 330 to the year 1453. It began when, under Constantine, the Roman Empire was split administratively between the Eastern Empire and the Western Empire. Now, this was sort of a continuation of trends that had been continuing for a long time. Constantine just kind of had the wisdom to say that the empire would be much more effectively administered if there was a capital in the West, which remained Rome, and a capital in the East, which was the new city of Constantinople. Well, new city in a sense. Byzantium is the name of the ancient town where Constantinople was built. That's why we call it the Byzantine Empire. The Byzantine Empire stood firm against the decline and the eventual collapse that overwhelmed the Western Empire with the fall of Rome in 410 and the eventual collapse of the Western Empire in 476. You see, when we talk about the ending of the Roman Empire, almost always what we mean is the ending of the Western Roman Empire. In some sense, the Roman Empire continued in the East for another 1,000 years or more after the fall of the Western part of the empire. One of the most notable emperors of the Eastern Byzantine Empire, if we want to call it that, was Emperor Justinian. In the year 533, the Emperor Justinian sent his armies westward, hoping to reclaim some of the West back for the Roman Empire and against the foreign tribes that had conquered it. Justinian's armies made very impressive gains, and under him, the Byzantine Empire was at its largest geographically. It spread through much of what the former Western Empire was, at least up and through the Balkans and a good part of North Africa as well. But something interesting and catastrophic happened, as it often does in the course of history. As it went west through the Italian peninsula, the very south of Spain, much of North Africa and the Near East was also under the domination of Justin. But soon, Justin's empire was shaken by the bubonic plague. And with 25 to 50% of the population struck down, some people estimate that up to 100 million people died in the plague, the bubonic plague that came upon the world, Justin's empire, in those years. That ended the dreams of reconquering from the East. But the Eastern Empire still flourished until the rise of Islam. Yet the Byzantine Empire remained. It was centered in the great city of Constantinople, under attacks from Goths, from generally the north and the west, and then later Muslims, especially Turks from the east. The empire kept shrinking, despite it having something of a resurgence in the 11th century. If we want to kind of take a little timeline through maps, we can see once again that under Justinian, the Byzantine Empire had a lot of the same kind of territory that the former Roman Empire, the Empire of the West, held, including the Italian peninsula and much of North Africa and some of Spain. But then we see in coming centuries, in the year 717, the Byzantine Empire was constrained to having not many of its same holdings in the West, and it had retreated in the East back up to the Euphrates River. All that territory that was lost in northern Africa and into Egypt was lost to the Islamic invasions. By the year 876, the Byzantine Empire controlled more of the land to the west of Constantinople, but their ambitions were checked even more to the east. And then we see in the year 1265 that it was shrinking even still, now considering much of the Balkans. And then finally, until the year 1400, that basically the Byzantine Empire was a city-state around the city of Constantinople. It was just shrinking, 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 basically because of the pressure of the Gauls from the west and the north, and eventually, and more powerfully, Islam, mainly from the east. So eventually the Turks conquered Constantinople in the year 53, and the Byzantine Empire was gone. Now, even though the Byzantine Empire lasted a long time, it wasn't especially politically stable over those centuries. 29 different Byzantine emperors were either murdered or debilitated while in office. If they were debilitated, it was usually by blinding them. And so it wasn't particularly stable. There was a lot of upheaval, but it was enduring. It was stubborn, if you want to use that word, long-lasting. Now, if you would have spoken to somebody in what today we call, and in this lecture we're calling, the Byzantine Empire in the 10th century, they wouldn't have called themselves the Byzantines. They wouldn't have called themselves Eastern. They wouldn't have called themselves Orthodox. They just considered themselves to be Romans and Christians. And they lived in what remained of the Roman Empire after the Goths conquered what was west of them and the Muslims conquered what was east of them. But this all gets back to this profound division that existed between Eastern and Western Christianity. You see, the Eastern Orthodox Church that exists to this day reflects the Christian traditions and theology that comes forth from the Byzantine Empire. From the perspective of the Eastern Church, Eastern Byzantine Christianity is original Christianity, and it is Orthodox Christianity. That's how they think of themselves. They would say that Western Christianity officially split from true Christianity in the year 1054. And the underlying issue in the year 1054 seems to be the attempt for the Western popes and leaders to claim more and more authority in and over Eastern Christianity. For many reasons, whenever Western popes tried to exert their authority over the East, Eastern Christians simply said, no, thank you. They felt that they had true Christianity and they didn't need the help from the West. And in many ways, they also felt that they were superior to Europe. And let me tell you, in the general period of church history that we've been considering in these lectures, that period from 300 to the year 1000, there was good reason for Eastern Christians to feel superior. Their empire had not yet fallen the same way that it had fallen in the West. They still had much more of a viable infrastructure and institutions to keep society going. Now, in the year 1136, a Catholic bishop named Anselm of Havelberg, he visited Constantinople on a diplomatic mission. And while he was there, he engaged in a public debate with the Orthodox Archbishop of Nicomedia. His name was Nicetas. Anselm put forth the traditional claims for the supremacy of Roman Christianity, the Roman Catholic Church. He said, hey, Peter founded the church at Rome. Jesus gave the keys of the kingdom to Peter. And Nicetas replied that the Holy Spirit did not descend on Peter alone at Pentecost, but on all of the apostles. All Christians had the right to be consulted about matters of faith and practice. One speech of Nicetas in particular sums up the Orthodox views of the matter, I think, sums it up very well. Here's this little speech, or a portion of a speech, from Nicetas, the Archbishop of Nicomedia, in 1136. He said this: "We do not deny to the Roman Church the primacy among the five sister patriarchs, and we recognize her right to the most honorable seat at an ecumenical council. But she has separated herself from us by her own deeds, when through pride she assumed a monarchy which does not belong to her office. How shall we accept decrees from her that have been issued without consulting us and even without our knowledge? So this is just sort of reflective of some of the great division that there existed. Eastern Christianity felt that it was doing just fine and it didn't need the management or the input of Western Christianity centered in Rome, centered on the Pope. And so they rejected the idea that they should be subjected under the Pope to be truly Christian. Well, this rivalry, competition, sometimes hatred between East and West came to a new low, we should say, where in the year 1204, the Crusaders attacked and plundered Constantinople on their way to the land of Palestine or the Holy Land, whatever you want to call it in this respect, to free it from Muslim influence. That obviously did not help the relationship between East and West at all. And by 1274, at a council held at Lyon in France, Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox leaders tried to work out some kind of formula of unity. The Byzantine Empire at that time was under greater and greater pressure from Islam, and it was continuing to decline and shrink. Perhaps if they had stronger and better ties with Christians in the West, that would sort of be a lifeline, a help to them. You know, maybe the same armies of crusaders that came and did evil upon Constantinople and the Eastern Christians, maybe similar armies could come from the West and help them against Islam. Perhaps all of that could happen, but the Orthodox delegates to the council did make many concessions, I should say, but the overwhelming majority of Orthodox clergy and laity rejected the idea of union with Rome, of coming underneath the Roman Catholic Church. The sister of the Byzantine emperor summed up their attitude. She said this, "Better that my brother's empire should perish than the purity of the Orthodox faith." Well, there was another attempt made in 1438-39 when the situation of the Byzantine Empire was even more desperate. I think you remember the map that I showed you in the 1400s when the Byzantine Empire was just very, very small. Just basically, Constantinople was a city-state, not much beyond that. And so the idea is that they needed help, and this council was held in Florence. Even with the Byzantine emperor and the patriarch of Constantinople attending. Now, again, the Eastern Christians, represented by the emperor of the Byzantine Empire and the patriarch of Constantinople, the Eastern Christians made many compromises. A lot of deals were made, and a final agreement was accepted, but then finally rejected by the Eastern Christians. A Byzantine nobleman said this. He said, "I would rather see the Muslim turban in the midst of the city than the Latin mitre." The mitre is a reference to the kind of hat that a bishop or the pope would wear. And basically what he was saying is, "I would rather be ruled by the Muslim Turks than I would by the Roman Catholic Europeans." Some 15 years later, Constantinople was a Turkish city. They were thoroughly conquered. Now, that was definitely not the end at all, by any means, of Eastern Christianity. And throughout its history, the Orthodox Church has not been a single church, but rather a family of 13 self-governing churches. So there's a Greek Orthodox Church, a Russian Orthodox Church, a Bulgarian Orthodox Church, and so on. They are united in their understanding of the sacraments, doctrine, liturgy, church government, but each one of them administers their own affairs. There's no pope over all of Orthodox Christianity. the way that there is a pope over all the Roman Catholic Church. Now, the head of each one of these churches, Russian, Bulgarian, Greek, Armenian, Antiochian, on and on, the head of each one of those churches is called a patriarch, or sometimes a metropolitan. The Patriarch of Constantinople, that is today modern-day Istanbul, Turkey, he's sometimes considered to be the universal patriarch, sometimes called the ecumenical patriarch. He does enjoy special honor, but really he doesn't have any special power over the other 12 Orthodox communions. When I think about Eastern Orthodoxy as a branch of the Christian faith, my observation, you can take this or leave it as you please, I see them as being less concerned with logic and answers. And they're more comfortable with just accepting the idea that God and his ways are unknowable and incomprehensible. This is reflected in some of their writings. John of Damascus, a famous Eastern Orthodox theologian, he wrote this in the 7th century or 8th century, probably. He said, "It is plain then that there is a God, but what he is in his essence and nature is absolutely incomprehensible and unknowable. All that is comprehensible about him is his incomprehensibility." In other words, the basic idea is the only thing you can know about God is that he can't really be fully known. So this kind of emphasis a little bit on accepting uncertainty and not worrying about having all the answers and simply receiving maybe through the sacraments and the experiences of the church, instead of trying to, what I would say, and I don't mean this in a insulting way, what I would say is understanding and figuring out there's more just receiving. Another way this is illustrated is through a story. Orthodox Christianity is filled with wonderful stories between great thinkers or great philosophers of their faith and people seeking them for answers. So one day some of the brethren came to see Abba or Father Antony, and among them was Abba Joseph. Wishing to test him, the old man mentioned a text from Scripture, and starting with the youngest, he asked him what it meant. Each one explained it the very best that he could, but to each one the old man said, "You've not yet found the answer." So finally, to the last one, to a man named Abba Joseph, he said, "And what do you think the text means?" He replied, "I do not know." Then Abba Antony said, "Truly Abba Joseph has found the way, for he said, I do not know." Again, that's from the 6th century sayings of the Desert Fathers. And in a previous lecture, we spent a long time talking about Anthony of Egypt. But again, just kind of that, I don't know, acceptance or being comfortable with the unknown and the unknowable is, I think, a very important feature of Eastern Orthodoxy. I would also say that Eastern Orthodoxy emphasizes material, symbolic lessons and representations of God. In an Orthodox service, you'll notice the icons, the paintings, the mosaics, the robes, the vestments of the priests. You'll notice the bells and the incense and the candles and the sounds of chanting. It's been said that the Orthodox express their theology in images rather than in ideas. So again, these icons, for example, have been a long-standing feature of Eastern Orthodox Christianity. Sometimes these icons, paintings and such, have been the cause of great controversy. Matter of fact, in the year 726, there was a very significant iconoclast or anti-icon or icon-destroying movement under the Byzantine Empire Emperor Leo III. He ordered that all images or icons be removed from the churches and destroyed. And there was a huge dispute in the empire, most of them clergy being pro-icon. There were waves of iconoclastic violence But by the year 843, the place of icons was very secure in the Eastern Church. The iconoclasts had three main arguments, and it just kind of occurs to me as you saw the previous graphic. That graphic doesn't really depict people in Eastern clothing at all, but Western clothing. That's probably talking about a more Western iconoclastic controversy, but you get the idea. This idea of forcibly removing icons. But the iconoclasts had three main arguments. First of all, they said that icons are idols. Since a painting of Jesus is obviously not Jesus Christ in the flesh, it must be a false image or an idol. Secondly, the iconoclasts said that icons are not supported by church tradition. And then third, they said icons can't show us the true Jesus because whatever they picture in Jesus is only his humanity and not his deity. Now, icon supporters believed that the incarnation made everything different. When God became man, and in a visible material way, it meant that it was now permitted to make images of Jesus and the saints and to use them as tools in worship and devotion. Icon supporters argued that icons are more spiritual pictures than they are historical paintings. They would say that they're like little painted sermons more than they're meant to be actual representations of people. Icon supporters were careful to say that true worship belongs to God alone and to nobody else. But at the same time, it's only right to venerate icons, not to worship them. They believe that the honor given to the icon is actually given or transferred to that which it represents. So if a right icon represents Jesus and you venerate or honor the icon in any way, that honor or veneration is transferred to Jesus. So again, with all of this in Orthodox or Eastern Christianity, there is very much this emphasis on the physical, on the experiential, on the candles, on the vestments, on the structures of the ceremonies, on the incense, on the icons, all the rest of it. All of this is just very characteristic of Eastern Orthodox Christianity. Now, I would also say that Eastern Orthodoxy does not have an emphasis on sola scriptura. That was that great principle emphasized in the Protestant Reformation, that the Bible alone should be our source of doctrine, and it alone should be our final authority. Generally, I would say that the Eastern Orthodox believe that God speaks through the Bible, of course, but that also God speaks with authority through tradition, through councils, through liturgy, and perhaps even through icons. You could say that Eastern Orthodoxy does not think first in terms of justification. You know, that thing that was so important in the Protestant Reformation. That great question, how can I be saved? Instead of thinking first in terms of justification, instead they give more prominence to the idea of theosis, that is, of becoming like God. That's the important concept. Now, I want to be very clear. Orthodox Christians don't believe that Christians become gods. That's not the idea at all. But that they are to focus on becoming more and more like Jesus and God the Father. To use sort of Romans terminology, that we should be conformed into the image of God's Son. Eastern Orthodox Christians put a lot of emphasis on what are known as the seven ecumenical councils, these seven great councils in church history that were called to debate and to decide important doctrinal ideas. They represented Christians from both Eastern and Western traditions, even though they mostly had Christians from the Eastern traditions. Now, I covered these in a previous lecture, so we're just going to go through these very quickly. The seven ecumenical councils that are very important in the thinking and in the theology of Eastern Orthodox Christians are, first of all, the Nicene Council, where 318 bishops met, focusing on the Arian heresy and affirming that Jesus is fully divine. The second is the Council of Constantinople in 381, 150 bishops met, focusing on the divinity of the Holy Spirit and the doctrine of the Trinity. Then in 431, the Council of Ephesus, 200 bishops met, rejecting the Nestorian teaching that Jesus was one person with two separate natures. We've talked about that in a little bit of our previous lectures. Then number four, there was the Chalcedonian Council, 451, 630 bishops met. They were opposing the Monophysite teaching that the divine nature of Jesus overwhelmed his human nature, and stating that Jesus was both human and divine, the two natures being united without confusion, without change, without division or separation. Then there was the Second Council of Constantinople in 553, where 165 bishops met, reaffirming the teachings of previous councils regarding the nature of Jesus and the Holy Spirit. Then number six, you've got the Third Council of Constantinople in 680, where 170 bishops met, focusing on the idea that Jesus had both full human and divine wills that were united in harmony under the leadership of the divine will. And then finally, the Second Council of Nicaea in 787, where 367 bishops met, deciding that icons are permitted, but that they cannot be worshipped. Now, one thing that I think is very important to say about Eastern Orthodox Christianity, that Christianity that is a descendant of the Byzantine Empire and Christianity in the East. Throughout history, I think it's undeniable that Eastern Orthodox Christians have endured more persecution than Roman Catholics or Protestants. This is because they were the main focus of both Muslim and communist persecutions. When we think about the blood of martyrs through the centuries, it is predominantly Christians from the East that have borne that brunt. And for that alone, they deserve great honor and great respect, I think, even though, let's just say this, I am comfortable with my Protestantism. I am comfortable with my emphasis on the scriptures and having very little emphasis on tradition. I'm comfortable with a worship experience that isn't so suited to the senses of smell and, you know, ambiance and the vestments of a more plain. I'm comfortable with all those things, but I don't despise at all my Orthodox brothers and sisters for their pursuit of Jesus through their own traditions. Now, let me mention one more thing about Eastern and Orthodox Christianity before we leave. That would be how the Russians came to adopt Christianity in the year 988. Christianity had penetrated what we call Russia in the early 900s, when at least one church had been built in the ancient city of Kiev. But in the 950s, Olga, who was the grandmother of the future King Vladimir, was baptized as a Christian. She asked the German King Otto I to send missionaries to her country, but apparently they met with very little success. Now, Olga's grandson Vladimir practiced the old religions of his ancestors, and he built a number of pagan temples, and he was famous for his cruelty and his treachery. Vladimir had 800 concubines and several wives, and he spent his non-warring time in hunting and feasting. He didn't seem like the kind of person that would spread Christianity among the Ukrainians, the early, what we would call today, Russians. It's complicated in that part of the world, but actually it's in what is today modern-day Ukraine. But culturally, it has very strong connections with modern-day Russia. Well, Vladimir, in any regard, apparently wanted to unite the people under one religion. So around the year 988, he sent envoys to examine the major religions. What were the options? Islam, Judaism, and the Catholic Christianity of Western Europe, and the Orthodox Christianity of Eastern Europe. As of yet, there was no official break at that time between the Orthodox and the Catholic Christians, but there were very different traditions. So there's four options. I want to unify my people around a religion. Am I going to pick Judaism, Islam, Catholic Christianity, or Eastern Orthodox Christianity? And the story of Vladimir's choosing Orthodox Christianity, you could say that it's part legend, it's part fact. According to the legend, Vladimir didn't like the dietary restrictions of Islam and Judaism. Maybe he loved himself some pork, some bacon, and he didn't want to give it up. And Catholic Christianity was all right. He thought it was, it's okay. But what really impressed the great king, this prince over the Rus, in Ukraine there, in Kiev, Vladimir, what really impressed him was the dazzling worship that his ambassadors described seeing in the great cathedral of the Hagia Sophia in Constantinople. This is what those ambassadors said. "We didn't know whether we were in heaven or on earth, for surely there is no such splendor or beauty anywhere on this earth. We cannot describe it to you, only we know that God dwells there among men and that their service surpasses the worship of all other places. We cannot forget that beauty." So it was the beauty, the pageantry, the ceremony of it all that so impressed the ambassadors of Vladimir there when they came to that great building, the Hagia Sophia in ancient Constantinople. So Vladimir chose Orthodoxy because of its beautiful worship. And the name of Vladimir's chosen religion was in fact Pravoslavia, a word which means true worship or right glory. Now, Orthodoxy was also having become the religion of the most powerful, wealthy, and civilized of the nations that surrounded Russia's borders on the Byzantine Empire. So if Vladimir was impressed by Orthodoxy's beauty, he was also impressed by another beauty. There was a woman named Anna, the sister of the Byzantine Emperor Basil II and Constantine, who offered her to Vladimir as a bride if he would be baptized as a Orthodox believer. So in the year 988, Vladimir was baptized. In the year 989, he married Anna, and Vladimir then ordered all the inhabitants of Kiev to appear at the Dnieper River for baptism or to be considered enemies of his kingdom. Now, that doesn't mean that the kingdom became a Christian society right away, but with the help of monks, those were always an important force in Eastern Orthodox Christianity. Christianity really began to make its influence felt. Now, as for Vladimir himself, his lifestyle was clearly different. When he married Anna, he put away his five former wives, and he started building churches, and he destroyed idols, and he abolished the death penalty. He protected the poor. He established schools. He managed to live in peace with neighboring nations. And on his deathbed, he gave all of his possessions to the poor. So it seems that Vladimir was a man who was genuinely changed by his Christian conversion. And it was he who set in motion the existence of what we would call the Russian Orthodox Church. Even to this day, the legacy of Vladimir's choice lasts to this very time. Well, that's going to be it for this particular lecture. We're going to continue on with future lectures, and I hope that you can join us as we continue to chart the course of Christianity. Really, we're in this broad series of lectures, we're considering Christianity up to the time of Reformation. So we're just going to go up about to the year 1500 and leave it there as we make our way through this period of Christianity. Glad you could join us. Hope you can join us for future lectures.